Take the British Isles. In that small area, there were originally some 6 languages, and there are quite obviously, and to this day, these distinct peoples. You have the English, properly speaking, of England. You have the Welsh of Wales, the Scottish in Scotland, and they rather divided between the Highlanders and Lowlanders. And then you have the Irish over the way in Ireland, and various other odd islands with people like the Manxmen and so on. Well, when it comes to trying to create a parliamentary form of rule, the composition of the government depends very much on what is to be included. Supposing you have the question, should Wales have home rule? Should it be self-governing? That's a question that somebody might easily be raising someday. You try to solve that by democratic means. Well, who's to do the voting? You take a vote in Wales, and there we'll say you get a majority for people saying we want our own government. But then it's arguable. Why take the vote only in Wales? Why shouldn't it be a vote in England and Wales to decide whether the English think that the Welsh ought to have self-government? Then the Scottish come into it. Well, should it be a vote of the British Isles as to whether Wales should be self-governing? Now, the function of monarchy in many cases has been, in fact, to carve out a particular area, a kingdom, as called originally, and say, this is a political unit, it is defined by these frontiers, it is characterized by this language, this is a kingdom. And once the kingdom has become fixed in that sense, Portugal, shall we say, Portugal might quite easily have been part of Spain. Historically, it's come out to be the Kingdom of Portugal, which it then becomes possible for someone to come along later and say, this is the Republic of Portugal, and now the dictatorship of Portugal, eventually, someday. You can call it the democracy, perhaps, of Portugal. But all those processes seem to me impossible until someone has first of all created Portugal. Mm-hmm. And that has usually fallen to a king.
Well, it usually isn't the kind of problem that you solve by a conscious decision. It's the result of centuries and centuries of history. That is the definition of the area of a state. But in India and in the United States, the decision was made on a democratic basis, wasn't it? The decision, for example, to separate Pakistan and India, as well as the definition of boundaries in the original
constitution. Well, was that made in a democratic way? That was a British decision as the only way to do anything at all.
I think there was an agreement between the Muslim League and the Congress Party, wasn't there?
There was a certain agreement between parties, but that's not the same thing as being a plebiscite of the people.
Oh, yes, well, of course, I agree with you.
And if you'd come to a plebiscite of the people, then you get the question, who is to vote? And that is where, incidentally, in India, and I'm glad you brought that case up, because there you have this case of Kashmir.
Yeah.
Which is sort of in between the two. Now, how can you solve the Kashmir problem by democratic means?
Well, they might revert temporarily to monarchy to get it solved and then go back again.
They might do that. It's not a democratic means of solving the problem.
Are there any grounds for thinking that perhaps this wave of dictatorship that we've been witnessing is only temporary and perhaps the drawing back for a new spring forward?
All dictatorships are temporary in their nature, and it's a phase that one would expect not to last very long. One would have thought that the Second World War represented a triumph for the democracies over the dictatorships of Germany and Italy, and that that should have spelt the end of dictatorship, and that democracy would have been shown to have been more efficient, even at fighting, and that the tendency would then have been back to parliamentary rule. But that hasn't happened. Since the Second World War, more dictatorships have come into being.
From what you've said, dictatorship seems to be an awfully promising career for a young man. If you had to do it all over again, how would you go about establishing yourself in a hypothetical country, and what would your expectations be?
That's a very interesting question. You'll probably notice from now on a difference in my voice. Instead of the bland tones of a professor, you'll begin to hear the sharp bark of one accustomed to giving orders to cringing thousands. Well, let's start off with the situation in a country where there has been increasing disorders of various kinds, conflicts between different groups of socialists and reactionaries, and eventually end in civil strife, actual fighting of some kind. Now, I have had the opportunity of seeing a town in the hands of rioting mobs for as long as 48 hours. The one thing that's clear about that sort of situation is that someone, sooner or later, has to give the order to fire. And people are awfully unwilling to do that. They feel that if they give the order to fire, they may become terribly unpopular, and quite apart from that, they may get disowned by their own side. You know, that's always rather the nightmare of the army officer, that he'll be called in aid of the civil power. And he has this uneasy feeling that if he shoots, he'll be tried for murder, and if he doesn't shoot, he'll be court-martialed for dereliction of duty. So one way and another, he can't do right. But on the whole, where the situation is really bad, it's better to shoot. And we've all been taught at some stage or another that if you shoot, you shoot to kill. None of this business of firing over the heads of the crowd, which merely kills innocent people 2 miles away. Instead of that, you fire into the crowd. The particular routes that I saw, after going on for 2 days, were completely dispersed by firing approximately 20 rounds, which was all that had ever been needed. Well, let's suppose that all this has been going on, and that I am a commander who is in a situation such as Napoleon was in Paris on one celebrated occasion, when the other side is rioting about the center of the city, and he issues his orders in Napoleonic terms, naturally, and he says, fire. And he opened fire with artillery. He was a man to stop at nothing. Anyway, he was a gunner. So he gave them the works, if I may be allowed to use that expression, and we'll suppose that I've done the same, and found myself dictator on the following morning, which is more or less what happened to him. Some people are very grateful to me for having brought the strife to an end. Other people are regarding me with considerable hatred. These are the types whose relatives have been shot down in the open streets, and they take rather a poor view of it. They think it's a bad show. Well, the result is that I'm in power, and I find straight away that it doesn't suit me very well to have very able commanders immediately round me. The trouble would be there is one of prestige, that you get a general who's as good as you are, and on some occasion he may possibly make you feel small. He may know more than you do. He may win a victory and come back in triumph at a time when possibly your troops have been less successful. Well, that would never do at all. So I start by removing all the generals of obvious ability. Some of them are advised that their time for retirement has come. Others have unfortunate accidents of one kind or another, these things that befall people, and others are sent off to command in distant garrisons where no fighting is expected. And then I get the army and the forces generally completely under my control. My own immediate followers, loyal types, not much brains perhaps, but loyal, are given command in various places, and then I feel that I'm pretty safely in command of the whole thing. I find I need some brains round about, and I need them for propaganda. I'd look round Madison Avenue for some suitable types to recruit on the propaganda side. Public relations, they're very important these days. And so we could have some brainy people of that kind. There would be no risk of their superseding me, of course. They wouldn't have that sort of personality. So there we're beginning to get the situation properly under control. Now, my dangers would be that if everything was very calm and prosperous and peaceful for a long period, people would begin to wonder what they had a dictator for. You know, after all, it's a thing for a period of crisis. So on the whole, we need a recurring crisis of some kind in order to justify dictatorship. Crises can be of various types, but the commonest kind is of war. And, of course, the best war is against an obviously inferior opponent whom you can defeat economically, exaggerate the numbers of the enemy considerably, and come home once more in triumph, and have one of those plebiscites where you obtain 97% of the vote instead of the 95% of the original plebiscite that brought you into power. I think we'd probably have one or two minor conflicts of that kind. They'd be minor in fact, but quite considerable when they appeared in the press and over the radio. And then people would all turn to themselves and say, how fortunate that we have a military genius of the first order as our ruler, who brings us safely through these dangerous and dreadful crises. So all the time prestige would be mounting, and there'd be very particular attention given to cinema. A lot can be done with cinema. I seem to remember films of Mussolini in the 1930s when he was being filmed without realizing it. And he was talking quite like a human being to various people around him. Suddenly he became aware of the camera. He stiffened into a dictatorial posture. His jaw thrust out. His arms were folded. And he looked sternly before him. And everyone in the cinema where I was roared with laughter. At any rate, it showed the way you have to pose in front of the camera. And dictators sort of learn that. And they also usually manage to censor the film afterwards to make certain that there are no unfortunate episodes of that kind, of being photographed from the wrong angle at the wrong moment. That will never do. So we go on for a time. Now, what goes wrong with this? Well, one trouble is on this question of eliminating all these other able types who may have been around. And the other one arises from the propaganda. These are the two aspects of it, the elimination of the fit and the propaganda to support the regime. Now, the trouble about the elimination of the fit is that I've gradually surrounded myself, unconsciously, with an awful lot of people whose only ability is in saying what I want them to say. And so whatever I do, they all rally round and applaud loudly and say, splendid fellow, there's no one like our Führer, our Duce. He's the man to meet every crisis. And they all applaud furiously all the time, and each time they do, they receive some promotion, some fresh decoration, some fresh order or medal on the chest. And this goes on all very well for a time, and so does the propaganda. The snag about the propaganda is that sooner or later I come to believe in it. I don't know whether this happens to advertising people after they've for a long time been plugging some particular soap, whether they really come to think that this soap is better than any other. Possibly it does. It certainly seems to happen to dictators. They come to believe their own propaganda. And at last, perhaps by accident, they drift into war against a more serious opponent. And there's the mischief. Because to start with, I'm surrounded by all these completely useless people whose only ability is in applauding me. To make matters worse, they're so terrified by this stage that they don't tell me the truth. So as the campaign proceeds, they come back with reports of imaginary victories, and by that time I've so believed my propaganda of invincibility that I believe them. And their casualties are disguised, the numbers of the enemy are minimized, and I end up with a completely false impression of what is going on. And by this time, I'm, to all intents and purposes, off my head, because I'm living in a private world of my own in which everything goes just as I think it should. All my cronies are coming round telling me that the situation is just what I want it to be, and at the same time, one division after another is being massacred by the other side, and no one has even yet come in to tell me that the formation no longer exists. And so I end off in this sort of wonderful position in some bomb-proof dugout, surrounded by maps, and on the maps are put symbols representing Army Corps divisions, navies, and units of air forces. And I'm issuing my Napoleonic instructions. People are running around moving the flags about the map, representing formations that were wiped out the week before, but no one has dared to tell me. And the general effect is highly impressive, but completely unreal. And I'm probably interrupted in the middle of it by finally the sound of shellfire coming nearer and nearer, and I realize, as Hitler did, that the moment has come to end it all.
Well, at least you didn't face the problem of succession.
No, I didn't get as far as that.
But of course, if you could have escaped, I should think you would have had a brilliant career on the stage.
Well, the trouble is with dictators, they don't seem to escape. I think many of them might, in fact, have had a brilliant career on the stage. Well, I've sometimes wished they'd had a brilliant career in the stage instead.
Well, perhaps we have something here. After all, Hitler was a frustrated painter. Mussolini was a newspaper editor. Well, I was going to turn to a rather serious note. You've alerted us to a point which I think ought to be taken very seriously, that it's a little bit too simple to say dictator equals bad, democracy equals good. And you make the point that sometimes dictators perform useful functions. In some vague sense, one might use the word good.
Venizelos was very greatly admired as ruler of Greece, and I think most people would agree that he was a dictator. Mustafa Kemal is, I think, without question, Kemal Atatürk, as he was called, the founder of modern Turkey. Most of its importance in the world, I think, today can be traced to him, and most Turks would probably agree to that. Very few people have anything much to say against Dr. Salazar, the present dictator of Portugal, who has ruled Portugal very quietly and unobtrusively for a great number of years, and apparently with perfect success. I think one could find many other examples.
What circumstances would you say are required for a dictatorship to be good?
Well, it's partly the character of the dictator, partly, I think, the amount of consent that he could command to his rule in the first instance. If there was a fairly universal demand for dictatorship, I think that the prospects of a reasonable kind of dictatorship are very much better. For example, I don't know whether de Gaulle is going to prove a distinguished and useful ruler of France. I don't even know whether he can be classed as a dictator. But I think it could be said with truth that the general desire of the people of France was for him to assume the power, and that that helps him a great deal, that he's not compelled to use great force to maintain his power in the first instance. He has a very considerable degree of consent and sympathy from the governed. All that would seem to point to the possibility of a prosperous and uncontested period of power.
Do you think that under the conditions that existed in Germany at the time, that even a Hitler with a good character could have been, quote, a good dictator?
I think it's not impossible. And in fact, in his early days, Hitler had probably several points in his favor. He was certainly very able in various ways, and I think perhaps someone of a different character might have produced a result less disastrous to the world at large. On the other hand, Hitler was peculiarly fitted to gain and maintain power in the situation as it was. And the doubt always crosses the mind whether the man we'd think of as a potentially good dictator could in fact have attained the office and kept it.
The very fact that Germany had such a deep experience with democracy.
Deep? What do you think of as deep?
Well, you had a very strongly organized democratic movement in Germany.
Ah, yes, but over a very short period.
Yes. Of course, the Social Democratic Party goes back to the 1870s.
It goes back to the 1870s, but as a successful party in power, its period was very short.
Shall we put it this way? With a intensively organized industrial society in which organized groups can play such a large role.
Yes.
Is there any other way of maintaining dictatorial power except by total suppression and all the techniques of totalitarianism? That was the point I was raising about Germany.
I think there probably are ways today, but they seem to me more sinister. I think that the developments of modern psychology, modern advertising, radio, television, cinema, state-controlled education, all the means of influencing opinion, put into the actual government in power, whatever it is, an extraordinary and unprecedented power for influencing opinion, so that you will end with the situation of the dictatorship by consent, but by a consent which has been worked up by this extremely efficient and modern technique of mass persuasion.
Well, as we look around at the temporary state of democracy, noticing no very powerful movements for social change, either in England or the United States, perhaps there isn't enough revolutionary spirit in democracy to make a dictatorship necessary anymore.
That may be so. In fact, I hope that it is so.
This would be a triumph of the American consumer, perhaps. They're too busy with television to worry about trying to change the power structure.
Yes, there are dangers even in that. You can end off with a whole country so hypnotized by shadows on screens as to be divorced from reality altogether.
With a few couches, we could get along very nicely.
Yes, you end up a sort of punch-drunk people who are more or less like drug addicts. I think there are dangers in this.
We started with the East, and Nirvana is a concept of the East, and perhaps your political cycle will end with a new technologically produced Nirvana. That'll be the end of it.
Yes, I think this is a new cycle of your own invention. You'll have to explain that.
Perhaps we could say this, that there are periods in history in which profound changes in social structure are taking place, seem always to produce dictatorship as one class replaces another. Perhaps if we look upon the absolute monarchies of the 17th and 18th century as dictatorships associated with the rise of the middle classes, perhaps we're going through only a similar temporary phase associated with the rise of the working classes.
You could do that, but I don't agree that the working classes have risen. The period of parliamentary rule, the period of votes, the period when all hopes were pinned on general elections and ballot boxes was very much a period of the working classes. It was exactly the period when the world's destinies seemed to be settled by large conscript armies, the strength of which was to be measured in the number of their bayonets. That age has passed, and on the whole, the workman of those days in the present century has mattered less and less. In industry, the skilled workman, the trades unionist, has got pushed out by the organization man, the managerial class on the one side, and the unskilled laborer. He matters less than ever before. Matters certainly less than he did during the last century.
And yet this wave of dictatorship is not in the long run, certainly, reverse this tendency to socialism, which must in some way improve the social position of the working class.
Well, it may do that, but the power structure in the present century is one peculiarly suitable for dictatorship, because the actual physical force in a country has come to be concentrated in a way that's far more easy to control than in the days of massed armies. A few tanks, a few machine guns, a few squadrons of jet bombers and fighters, backed up by the forces of radio and television, by all the forces of propaganda which are at the command of a modern ruler, make it far easier to concentrate power in the hands of a dictator or a small group of people, and far more difficult to disperse that power among the people at large. I think technologically, the 19th century formed a good background for growing parliamentary rule. I think that technologically, the 20th century does not form a good background for that form of rule. It seems to lend rather a different aspect to the matter. It seems to prepare the way for dictatorship.
The only question, then, I suppose, is not whether the trend to dictatorship exists, but how long it will continue.
In our next discussion, Dr. Parkinson, I should like to ask you about what seems to be the most stable of modern dictatorships, the Soviet Union. For you've already indicated that you have some very special notions about its nature as a theocratic system. I should like to hear more about that next time.